or someone you love wish you had a better job? Want to be happier on your current job? Don't even have a job? Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Michael Burnick has got degrees from Harvard and Oxford. He's got a law degree from both UC Berkeley's law school. He is the former head of California's Employment Development Department. We call it the Unemployment Department. He's currently a Milken Institute Fellow on Employment Policy. He's been on the show before. He was really good talking about other things. He's talked about jobs for people with Asperger's. He's talked about the future job market, which is my obsession these days. But he's also written about something interesting and different, which I know nothing about, zero. But I thought it would be, you know, even mildly entertaining, if not instructive. You know, so much of what we believe about the world comes from the media. And this show is about work. And so much of what we believe about work, ironically, comes from people who've never been in the real work world. They're writers and artists or whatever, whether they're writing the script for a sitcom or for a movie or TV news. They've gone from journalism school right to the microphone. They've never been in the real world. So these are the people who write about work and affect our views about work, about bosses, about employees, about ethics. You know, you watch Mad Men and you think everybody's an idiot or unethical. So what's the reality? So that's why I've got the guy back on the show with me, Michael Burnick. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Always good to be here, Marty.
Good, good, good. All right, let's start with the positive. What are some examples of how the media accurately portrays work?
Well, there's been a dramatic change in the way work is portrayed, and part of it reflects the employment part, the employment world, as you say. Because in popular culture, including in television movies, we learn a lot about employment, about the workplace, as well as finding a job. Even though, as you say, Marty, most of the people who write about it are divorced from it, and much of it is not accurate. But the last 5 to 10 years, we've had this dynamic of the work reality shows. Now, what shows are these? These are ones that our listeners are probably very familiar with. Cake Boss, America's Next Top Model, Tabitha's Salon Takeover, American Pickers, even Pawn Stars. These are shows that focus on the workplace. And in my view, we learn a lot from them. First, they show people working with craft, with care for detail. I think that's part of their popularity. Part of their popularity is just that they create good characters. Whether it be the people on Pawn Stars or Tabitha. But part of it is, I think we react to them in that they show people in a sense, everyday jobs who really care about those jobs, who go beyond the 9 to 5, who perform with craft and care and concern. And whatever one thinks about the universe of reality shows, these work reality shows, in my view, are one of the best things that have happened in popular culture in the last 50 years. They are very, very positive. They send good values. They send positive values. We can learn a lot. Whatever you think of the Real Housewives franchise or the other reality shows, these work reality shows are very different.
Let's take one of those to paint a little picture. Which one show do you know best, and you might kind of describe what goes on that show?
Well, Pawn Stars is one that my middle daughter, Elena, really likes, so I see more of. Now, on Pawn Stars, these are people, this is a family, you know, the old man, Rick, Corey, there are three generations, plus Corey's friend, Chumley, who work in a pawn shop in Las Vegas. Now, you'd say, what do we have to learn about? I mean, to most most writing about employment regards work in pawn shops, as in bakeries and others, as sort of throwaway jobs, jobs that you want to avoid.
Or sleazy people. You know, I think of Les Mis, yeah. Where the woman has to pawn her hair for, you know, 2 cents or whatever, and the woman, the pawn mistress gives her, no, 1 cent is all you're getting.
Exactly. So you'd think, well, pawn shops. But, you know, A, it's on the History Channel, so we learn each of these people bring in goods, and we learn about the history. And it's very interesting. You learn a lot about. But also, you show that they're not only running a business and trying to make money, but they're also trying to do it in a way that maintains antiques, that maintains values, that recycles material, and even more so on another show called American Pickers. I don't know if you've seen America. That's another. That's an excellent show where these two friends, Mike and Frank, they're pickers. They go out and they travel around the country and they buy things that we have in our garages or in, you know, in our
vintage items.
Vintage items. But what they're doing, and they say, if you listen to them, they on the surface they say, "Well, we'll buy anything that makes us money," but they're far more interested in beyond commercial values. They want to. They see things of beauty, things of value that should be restored, and in that sense, they're recycling materials. They're using materials most effectively. Very positive, and they care about their work.
That's something that does feel very accurate to me. You know, I really think that most people who are in their own businesses, yes, they are primarily in it to make money, but they are not unaware of the aesthetic or of the human or whatever. I do think, we'll get to the negative later, but I do think the media often portrays business owners as just evil, that all they care about is money and they don't care a bit about people. And I think there is that's a little not nuanced. But you piqued my interest when you said that in the pawn shop they told you interesting things about the history of pawn shops. Is there one that...
Well, it's not so much the history of pawn shops as much as the history of the particular goods. So somebody might bring an old revolver from the 1800s, and we'll get a lesson, and Rick or Corey will call in an expert, and that person will come in, and we'll learn about that. But again, the overall, overarching value there, as in American Pickers, as in America's Next Top Model, is to work with a real craftsmanship, that these aren't throwaway jobs. Mm-hmm.
Okay, good. Is there any, I want to stay on the positive a little longer, is there anything else in the way in which the media, and it could be news media, it could be movies, it could be sitcoms, it could be whatever, anything else that you want to give a kind of a shout out to about that's positive and legitimate and revelatory about the real world of work?
The work reality shows are the main positive development work. As you started by saying, most of what Hollywood does and the entertainment world does in portraying work in sitcoms or in dramas is inaccurate.
In terms of misportrayals, if there is one stereotype, I was alluding to it earlier, but it could all be reduced to one sentence from my perspective, but you know this field far better than I, which is boss bad, worker good. And that isn't quite as, black and white as that. Is that am I making a mischaracterization?
No, I think that's true. Very few people in Hollywood have worked in a real business. And so it's not only the orientation between boss and workers, but what you need to do to succeed in a business. See, the work reality shows, even if you look at Cupcake Wars or Cake Boss or other shows dealing with food. And the Food Network is excellent in conveying this. Hmm. Hollywood takes the view that what you need to succeed is either to do something duplicitous or you're lucky or so forth. Well, what these shows show is that you need much of what you do is very unglamorous, and you need to just stick with it, and you need to persevere, and all of those other values that take.
Could you give me an example from either the cupcake or the cake box or for any of these artists, what you call artisan crafts, bread makers, that might paint a picture for our listeners about what does it really take to be a successful artisan or small business owner where craft matters?
Well, Cake Boss is in some ways the most has become the most popular. It has its own spin-off shows. But here's a small it started as a small bakery in New Jersey, and each episode they're filling orders, they're making this theme cake or that theme cake. And it's not the theme that's important, but you show the workings of the bakery that they really want to do something of quality, that baking is not just throwing things in, and but there's a real craft, and that's what comes out even more on the Food Network. The Food Network, I think, is excellent also in conveying those values of work, not only the food itself.
You know, I found interesting, you know, normally, again, one of the ways the media tends to portray is the small little artisan is the good guy, the big corporate, you know, entity is the monster. So I was in Costco recently. If there was ever a big corporate monster, I mean, I think about the ultimate warehouse store, and I needed a cake, frankly, for... This I give as a thank you gift for people who donate generously to KALW during my hour. I invite them to come to brunch, and I very often have a cake that's custom made. Well, I had forgotten to get it custom made in advance, and I walk in there, and there is this woman who's wearing one of those white bonnets to keep her dandruff from getting into the icing, and I stop, and the store was just opening up. It's Sunday at 10 in the morning, and I stop her. And I tell her my situation, and she lights up. This is a woman who's probably making $15 an hour, and she lights up, and she says, you wait. And she runs, and I say, which cake you want? Which cake? And I pick out the cake, and she goes back, and I'm watching her through the glass, and she is with artisanry. She made a beautiful lettering and decoration in 5 minutes. She stopped what she was doing, and she did that. You know, corporations are human. I got to tell you, I was watching Steve Ballmer. You know, Steve Ballmer just retired from Microsoft. And I watched his speech, his retirement speech. And Steve Ballmer and Mike, specifically this big, old, bald, ugly guy, and Microsoft in general, seen as the big evil, he was crying. He got standing ovations. He ran off the stage with adrenaline pumping through his veins, with high fives, people yelling, we love you, Steve. That is not, and they didn't have to because he was leaving. These people in the audience were not going to get it. Their job was not going to be enhanced. There was passion and love. And that never gets displayed in corporate America. You know, the media never portrays that in corporate America. Tell me more about because you studied this. Tell me more about how you see the media portraying corporate America.
Well, it's not so much corporate America, Marty, in some ways, as the way work has been portrayed over the years that I think is very interesting and important for the employment world we deal with.
Before we get to that we're talking about, one of the images that came to mind is, I think the most vivid image I ever have about the way the media portrays corporations is Gordon Gekko, greed is good, all of that. I mean, are there counterexamples? Or is it really always that these corporations are monsters?
Well, if we thought for a time, we could probably come up with, but you're right, the general view, the general West Los Angeles view is that... large companies are engaged in environmentally damaging
and covering it up, of course,
and so forth. So there's very little that really understands what. But as I say, the one trend that's very, very positive the last 5 to 10 years are these work reality shows.
Right. I want to go off that because we discussed. Also, these are all popping in my head, and I swear this was not preparing for the show. These are just popping in the head. I think about popping into my head. I think of Up in the Air. That takes a slice of corporate life. George Clooney as the guy who's brought into mass fire, people after people, and he's cold, and he ruthless. He's got this rigorous procedure that keeps people calm, and gets them to just quietly go away. It's like it's 1984. You got to help me here. There's got to be more positive portrayals, apart from these craft things. I wanted to, or at least let me ask you.
Well, in that book, Up in the I will say, Marty, Walter Kern's book, Up in the Air, is a little more nuanced. Mm-hmm. But you're exactly right. Up in the Air, big corporation is portrayed as heartless, firing people, and the good guys are those who sort of step aside.
Let's go away from the craft shows because we've kind of beaten that horse enough. Take me in another direction. What would you like to talk about how media is portraying work?
Well, I think it's what's interesting is the way work has been portrayed on over the past 40, 50 years. In the early days of television, you don't really see much focus on employment. Employment, in some ways, is taken for granted.
Right. Ozzie and Harriet were, Ozzie never saw Ozzie's work.
Never
we
saw
didn't know what
Ozzie.
The hell he did. Right.
Don and I are watching old episodes of Leave It to Beaver.
Right, exactly.
Well, Ward has a job, but there's no sub-themes of employment. The same with
right.
My Three Sons or Father Knows Best.
Right.
A steady job is taken for granted.
Right. They come home with their briefcase
exactly.
and their suit, and then and that's where everything starts.
Everything is, it reflects 50s employment. We were running unemployment rates below 4% at points during the 1950s and even throughout the 60s. And in fact, when work is portrayed, it largely is not concerned about finding a job.
Right.
But it's meaning in work. One of my favorite movies, all time, but certainly of the 70s, is Marty, have you seen, there's a 1976 film called Lifeguard.
Uh-uh.
It was a small film and with Sam Elliott. He plays Lifeguard Rick.
Hmm.
And Lifeguard Rick has been a lifeguard, I think it's Hermosa Beach, for 15, 20 years. And he's coming up to a high school reunion and his friends say, you got to get off of being a lifeguard.
That's for teenagers. You know, what are you doing?
Yeah, exactly. It's for teenagers. And he does meet with a old classmate of his who's a car salesman. And he wants him. And of course, in the end, he decides to not become a car salesman, but to stay on the beach. And the point is, obviously, that he finds meaning and is able to help people as a lifeguard in a way he can't in other jobs. The idea of meaning in work is key in the 60s and 70s. By the 90s and today, it becomes much more of a concern. You really see it first, I think, there's a 1993 movie, Falling Down, with Michael Douglas.
One of the most powerful movies
I've
ever seen.
It is. I agree.
Tell us about he's the ultimate alienated guy.
He is. He's a defense worker who's laid off.
Right.
Now there are not that many defense or aerospace workers left, so it would be another field. But the point is, he's become redundant. He's
right.
downsized, and he then, embarks on this walk across L.A. where he gets in various adventures. But he is, as you say, the ultimate alienated guy, and it begins to capture this displaced worker dynamic and concern that it's not just finding meaning in work, but finding a job is suddenly becoming a...
You know what my intuition is? I'm just a feeling.
Yes.
We've got 10 minutes left, and I want to switch gears. You weren't expecting this. You weren't expecting
right.
any of this. But, you are uniquely, more than any human being on the planet. Not this stuff about the media is all well and good, but I think we've covered it enough.
Okay.
But you know, if on planet Earth, you know more about the challenges of people with Asperger's trying to find work. And we, of course, have continuing conversations about how best to address that really thorny issue. But because you are truly almost uniquely qualified as somebody who was the head of California's Employment Development Department, so you know all about the world of employment, but you have a kid with Asperger's, and you are very actively involved, I don't know if you're the president or whatever, of a job club for Asperger's people. So you are the guy about that. I want to ask you a softball, open-ended question. Teach my listeners what they should understand about people with Asperger's and, in general, people with disabilities and trying to find employment in today's world.
Well, as you say, Marty, I am involved. We have a group called Ascend, which is open to everyone.
A-A-S-C-E-N-D. Where is it? Let's say it. Might as well tell where it is now and when they meet.
Well, probably the best way is to go on the internet and connect to Camilla or Greg, our co-chairs, but it's a group. I just stumbled on it a couple of years ago.
So just Google A-A-S-C-E-N-D, you'll get
yes,
there.
Yes, and it's the group for adults on the autistic spectrum.
Right.
I just stumbled on it 2-3 years ago, and I have found it an excellent, excellent community of adults, that is adults on the autistic spectrum and family and parents and friends.
You say it's excellent, but you've also told me how small a percentage of the Asperger's people end up getting jobs. So what makes it excellent?
Well, it's excellent as an organization. Now, we are working together to try to address this question of greater employment for people on the spectrum, which is estimated loosely at over 60-70% unemployment.
Right.
And even that's probably generous.
Exactly.
It's probably 80% more.
Yeah, right.
And we haven't found a simple thing. We have now three strategies. We have our online job board or job community that Brian Jacobs is putting together. Again, it's open to everyone on LinkedIn, and we hope people join. It's the Spectrum Employment Community by Ascend.
You say it's a job board, meaning that the job listings are placed or queries about job searching?
Well, we're just building up. It was just launched a couple weeks ago. It's going to be an attempt to build a network, because at the center of our approach to all of this with autism employment is the network. That in competitive employment, Marty, as we've discussed numerous times, it's not going to work. As you point out, when you came to address the group, you know, Google is getting 2,000 applicants a day unsolicited.
Without people without disabilities.
Yes. So you're not, you know, the best approach we've found is the traditional network approach. Can you, through family and friends, build up a network? And we've tried to do that generally offline. Now we're doing online.
When we hear the word disability, we think of somebody in a wheelchair and how biased and how unfair of employers to not hire somebody. But I'd like you to paint a picture, and if you don't mind, take your own son. Your own son has a college degree.
William does, and from Cal State East Bay.
Right, and yet you say that that employers even despite your background, you have not been able to get a government agency or a corporation or whatever to hire him. Paint a picture for our listeners of what the disability mean of Asperger's means in day-to-day work that makes them so difficult to hire and, more importantly, keep them hired.
Well, I think the starting point is that each of these people are different. I know it sounds trite, but it really is true. Each of them have certain skills and limitations, so it's hard to generalize. Mm-hmm. William is now in an internship program with Alameda County. We're hopeful that will lead to a job. We'll see. But in general, our community job seekers have had great difficulty for the obvious reasons. Many of the limitations deal with social limitations,
paint
being able to apply.
Be specific. You say okay. Obvious. Paint what are those limitations in the real world, in an office situation? Tell me, paint the picture of what the reality is. I know everybody's different, but the modal, the typical person.
All right. Well, segment of this autism community would be people who have difficulty either concentrating on the work or just carrying through certain assignments in terms of not really computer use. And that's why I think there's promise in the computer network. But ability to work and carry out jobs, in an office setting, or back to your Costco example, Marty. You'd think Costco would be a good opportunity for people to work, or Best Buy, and so forth. But you need, as a salesperson on the floor, you need a lot of different skills. Things move quickly, and the ability to react quickly to situations. But in most ways, Marty, we haven't even gotten to that. Most companies get so many applicants, whether it's to work on the floor at Best Buy or at Costco, they're getting so many applicants. Exactly. Our guys aren't even getting in the door.
Absolutely.
They're not even near the door.
Exactly.
They're not even getting a response to sending in an application. So we haven't, in many ways, we're not even, the question of the workplace skills is important. But what we're finding is that in today's job market, we're not even getting there.
So that's a really critical point. Me, who's got all these awards as best career counselor or whatever, my clients are not getting in the door, despite my teaching. And my clients don't have Asperger's or are nowhere on the spectrum, and they have college degrees typically, and they're polished people, and they are getting ignored. That we get now to the core, the real core question, which has been, frankly, the dominant theme of my show for the last few months, which is, what the hell is America going to do about the hollowing out of middle-class jobs, where there are dozens or hundreds of job applicants? When Walmart opened up in Oakland, there were 1,500 applicants for 50 jobs or 100 jobs.
That aren't particularly high-paying jobs.
Precisely,
too.
Exactly.
Yeah.
The water district, I happen to know, in Washington, some county in Washington State, was paying $17.76. I remember the number because it was $17.76. $17.76 an hour to be a meter reader. They got thousands of applicants for 10 jobs.
Yeah.
This is what's going on. And anybody who who's at, I'm looking at Debbie Kennedy, my board operator, and she's nodding. Everybody who's listening, I know, is nodding. You're knowing this, that this is the case. And my obsession on this show has been to talk to getting world-class experts like Jaron Lanier, the head of Microsoft, one of the head of Microsoft's think tank. I've gotten brilliant people, and the answers are always leaving all of us, listeners and me, empty. What Mike Burnick, as you, as former head of the California Employment Development Department, what one strategy gives you any hope for refilling the hollowed-out middle class in terms of middle-class jobs?
I'd answer twofold. The hope for me, for you, Marty, for everyone, is that the same concerns have been expressed throughout the past 30 years, certainly. We were just talking off-air about The End of Work, a book that came out in 1994 and predicted there'd be no jobs. Well, he was wrong. There were a whole generation of new jobs that arose that people never foresaw. So what gives the greatest single hope is that this same concern about technology destroying jobs and lack of jobs has been around throughout the post-World War II period. And each time, we've been able to create enough and even more jobs to accommodate.
Got to counter that. I asked that of Jaron Lanier, and Jaron Lanier said the following. He says, this is different for the following reason. Technology has eliminated a relatively small amount of jobs. If there was a thresher built, so there was a few thousand people who no longer could thresh by hand. But when you have a knowledge economy where so much of knowledge is a piece of software that doesn't even need to be distributed by CD anymore, but is simply it takes a team of 10 or 20 geniuses to create the first piece of software, and then millions of them are automatically created, and manufacturing is so automated, and we're in a global economy where work that isn't automatable gets offshored, that we have a small number of, yes, highly paid knowledge workers who work for what he calls the siren servers, the Googles and the Amazons. And what are the new jobs really created? Part-time temp crap jobs working in restaurants and cleaning toilets and janitorial. The question is, how are we going to refill the hollowed-out middle class? And can you really look to technology as just because in the past it's kind of done well? Isn't it different now?
No, you make a good point. The fact that it's been done in the past is no guarantee that it will continue to be in the future. I'm just pointing out that we've had these same concerns for 50 years each time.
You got a concrete solution for me?
There's no one solution. I have four things that
one.
I'm
four
working.
Is good. I want to hear
I work on things. I try to work, as you know, Marty, on specific things that try to. So here are the four. I work. One, I think, even though I generally the jobs program, government job programs have not been that effective and have been very costly, I think a government program targeted at this SSI, SSDI population that includes people with autism, but includes a lot of other people who aren't even near the door. In some job capacity is needed. That's the one job program, I would say.
So a WPA-like program for the disabled.
Yes, or people on our SSI, SSDI roles, our disability roles, just as our welfare roles have gone down, our other roles, SSI, SSDI, have exploded.
Absolutely.
And it's that population that I think financially can make some sense, and that certainly is running unemployment rates much harder, higher than probably even the 60% cited. Beyond that, I think it becomes more difficult if you're a market-oriented person like you and I are.
I'm a mixed person, but go ahead.
Yeah, well, I think
you said you had four things.
The other ones have to do with we have to reevaluate the continued costs put on hiring, government costs in terms of unemployment insurance cost and other payroll costs. Obviously, these health care costs and the Affordable Care Act costs are driving, despite what some of the proponents say, are driving toward part-time work. So
paid family leave, just the cost of employing somebody
the
is
cost
so
of
expensive.
Employing. Yeah.
So that employers are automating, temping, offshoring, part-timing as much as they can.
All of that, plus the legal the liabilities that employers have to take on in hiring.
Ever more employer lawsuits, grievances, and especially as people are more desperate, they want to go try to go into the deep pockets of the corporation and, let's just say, sometimes inflate their claim of whatever.
I think we have to look at some ways of rebuilding employment, and part of that is to move away from not only stop the additional costs, but cut them back.
Start to roll back. But yeah, you said there were four. I want to hear all four.
Well, the other ones have to do with how we can work within the knowledge economy and the social media economy to try to maximize employment. It's true that we have a very vigorous, and we're really at ground zero in terms of the social media internet economy here in San Francisco. It's creating some jobs. It's not a big job creator. We're talking about less than 6% of the jobs.
Instagram has 6 employees.
Yeah, that's right. So these aren't big job generators, but I think we've got to continue to expand just because the knowledge economy is eliminating jobs, but it also has, you know, such low barriers to entry for these social media, internet commerce firms that I think there are strategies within that field of trying to expand job growth and expand inclusiveness.
One more. You want me to give you my last one?
Well, give me your last one.
You know, it's a reality one. You know, every time I speak to, you know, I have a very liberal client base, and every time I speak to somebody who's gone to the Peace Corps or otherwise, you know, helped at some social service agency in Latin America, I ask them about the people, and they, I think, correctly point out that people in these poor villages are net happier than middle-class Americans. As I walk down the streets of downtown San Francisco, or even as I take a hike every day around the Lafayette Reservoir, quite a middle class, which attracts a very middle-class people, people look unhappy. They say the eyes are the windows to the soul. People don't look you in the eye. They look worried. They have furrowed brows. I'm thinking that the American capitalist, and this is, you see, I'm not a pure free market guy, the American capitalist ethos, which says, make money, you will be happy if you go and buy cars and have nicer houses and whatever, is ultimately an empty game. And especially in an era where ever fewer people are going to be able to even attempt that, quote, that path to, quote, happiness, teaching people to realize that really what leads to lives of contentment are any work that is honorable, whether you're washing dishes or you are an artist making very little money for spare change voluntarily for people, and that your contentment and whether your life is well led is the artisanry that you speak of in your craft, whether it's baking bread or whatever, your relationships and how good a human being you are in trying to make the lives in your sphere of influence better, and a creative outlet. I think many people need a creative outlet, whether it be through writing or music or speaking or guiding people or being a nurturer or whatever. And I think the most important thing we could do in this economy, where I don't think the middle class jobs are coming back, is teaching people that maybe there is a silver lining, that there is a blessing in disguise, and it may help us to realize that the path to the life well led is very rarely centered around materialism. What's your reaction on that?
I think my reaction is the spiritual element is always important, and it would be great to get to that place for all of us. I think the question, Marty, is, and maybe it's because I've been rereading The Green of America, remember that, Charlie Reich's book, that has some of those same themes. It talks about this Consciousness 3, and that was written back in the late 60s, early 70s. You know, I think the vision is one that we should keep going after, because obviously that's key, and it would be key even if we didn't have this job scarcity, but especially in the land of job scarcity. The challenge is going to be how that works economically. In other words, if you say people should be able to go to even almost a pre-industrial state or, be able to pursue various interests, how do they survive? How do we survive? You know,
I've written over 2,000 articles in the single, you know, fortunately, because with the internet, you can track how many people read them. The single most read article of mine is how I could live decently on $20,000 a year. And it includes things like the most important thing is housing. And if you realize that you could live in a crummy little basement studio apartment that maybe even occasionally drips, you know, that's going to save you a fortune in money, and yet is ultimately not going to have a profound influence on your happiness or quality of life. It is much more the work you do, whatever, you know, that feel that you do it with a sense of quality, your relationships and your creative outlet. If you drive old cars, 20-year-old Toyotas can still have a lot of life in them, and you can buy them for $1,000, you know, rather than buying it and keeping them only until they drop. Those kind of decisions, and not going out for $10 drinks at a bar, but rather inviting somebody over for a glass of $2 Chuck, which costs 30 cents. I think it is those kind of decisions that would enable people to live on $20,000 or $30,000 a year and maybe even have better lives than they currently have in the fat cats living in their 4,000-square-foot house in Danville.
Well, I would say that the spiritual element, simplifying life, could be an important element. I think there are a lot of economic questions. I think you're right that part of the answer to the question of there are not enough jobs today is not how do we create enough jobs, but it may at least in part be how we change lifestyles.
I want to ask you one less overall softball question. You know I like you. I think you're a bright and interesting guy who is not an ideologue. You take ideas from the left and from the right and from the apolitical. You are in the real world of dealing with people who struggle. I just want to ask you an open one question. This is probably the last time you'll ever be on the show. So not that you were bad, just I don't have repeat guests, although you've been come back one time, which is very unusual. What's the one thing you haven't said to my audience related to any aspect of work that you, as somebody who was the director of the California Employment Development Fund, who is a Milken Fellow, who is a Harvard graduate, you know, an Oxford graduate, have a degree from UC Berkeley, you're a really special guy. What's the one thing you want to leave our audience with?
I would say, you know, having all those degrees and so forth, I spend a good amount of time as a volunteer job coach. And I will tell you, even with all those degrees and all the advantages I have, it is so brutal out there. For me, I go out there and have great difficulty finding people jobs. So it's all of us today. It's just a much different environment than we've had in the past, certainly than when I entered the job train field in the late 70s. All I can say is that I think, you know, it takes a village. We all need to work together. I think all of us with family and friends, not only as volunteer, but it's a matter of trying to reach out and help family and friends. And I hear from a lot of people who have children in their 20s and say, you know, my child can't do this and that. It's not their fault. It is so, so difficult out there. You got to reach out and
you know,
try to be
shame on me. Stick around. I want to invite our listeners to call. I mean, I am a career coach. That's what I do for a living all the time now. But I'll keep Mike here as kind of my tag team partner. If you are somebody who is struggling finding good employment and you want to get my take on things and Mike's as well, if as appropriate, I invite you to call. I call them a 3-minute workover. So whether you are seeking a job as a CEO or a clerk, or it's not you, someone you love, but whether they have a disability or not, and is simply seeking better work, and you want some legitimate basis for hope, some baby step, some new angle, whatever, I usually can provide it. As you know, you can see this is a show about reality, not ha-ha. This is not Oprah where they, you know, they say you can do anything. Give me a call. We'll give it a shot. I'll do my best to try to help. Sometimes I can help a lot. The phone number here will work with Marty Nemko and my guest Mike Burnick, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. I want to, again, I always try to balance the negative with the positive. Like we started the show with the positive. I want to tell you a story that's a good one, a real good success story. And it's completely politically correct. It's wonderful. Guy's name is Robert. And he works from home, makes a hell of a living with very little competition. How does he do it? He repairs and resells washers and dryers. But how does he get them? How does he make all that money? When middle-class people, or wealthy people, they replace their old machines all the time, even though they're perfectly good, or need a minor or need a repair, and they buy a new one. They just want to get rid of them. He comes and picks them up for free. Normally, Sears charges $75 or $100 to take it away. He comes, picks up these washers and dryers. Sometimes they're in refrigerators. Sometimes they're in perfect condition. Sometimes they need repair. And he fixes them. So he gets them for free. He sells them for about $130 a piece with a 30-day warranty. So he's got the ultimate profit margin. It costs him zero, and he's making $135 a pop. and he's been doing this for years, and he makes, and it's recycling. It's not getting stuck in the landfill. Isn't that a nice success story?
It's very, very encouraging.
And you know what else is encouraging? Well, no, I guess it's not. Maybe not. All our lines are lighted up. I guess that means that there's a hell of a lot of people who are going to use job help. So let's go to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko with my guest, Michael Burnick. What's on your mind?
Hi. Question is, since with a ZDD background, I'm curious what his advice is or whether he's aware of how difficult it is to use the state jobs website to use for the state, because I walked into the EDD place, 801 Turk in San Francisco, and the front desk and two people behind her and a guy who works in the back couldn't really figure it out, and this was a year ago. And they said there were changes coming, but it's amazing that people at the EDD couldn't use the state website.
Amazing. Michael?
Well, the CalJobs has changed. I would only say this, that when I first went to EDD looking for a job, and this was in 1970, Marty, it was an environment in which it was all in person, everything in person. That shifted in the late 80s and early 90s. And as you found out, listener, you know, now you walk into EDD and they have very few people there. Staffing has been greatly, greatly reduced. And so you're basically pointed to a computer to use CalJobs. To be honest, I wouldn't use CalJobs. There are 100 other online websites that are much better. Much better.
Like what?
Well, I think any of the local ones, Marty, look good, work well. Even Craigslist, I would say one's focused on either a local geography or on a particular sector. If you're interested in healthcare or technology or whatever the sector, it has become not only 10 job boards, there are 2,000 major ones.
Mike, we spend all this, the budget for EDD, as you know, is how many millions of dollars?
Billions.
Okay, so they can't even create a website that's usable? I mean, you said, I wouldn't use CalJobs. I mean, we've spent, you said, billions of dollars every year of our tax dollars to create this thing, and the basic software that people need to use is their CalJobs, and you say don't use it? You're the guy who was a former executive director of it?
I tried to kill CalJobs because I felt the private sector was doing it better and we didn't need it. But you know, there are other political reasons for the Department of Labor. My point is, Marty, don't worry about CalJobs. There are 100 other private sector, local and sector-based ones that are websites that are worth using.
And of course,
as we know, websites are only the starting point.
Yeah, and if the websites that are automatically localized are the aggregators. Indeed.com and SimplyHire.com aggregate all the job listings from Craigslist, from Dice, from AOL, from Monster. And so, you know, and they
can you recommend those for your clients?
As in job searching, they are the easiest way to access lots of jobs. I also advocate niche job sites that are industry specific. So if there is, you know, for example, the American Association of Architects, they've got a jobs listing website there, and they're going to get fewer hits than something that's on, if it's on Indeed or Simply Hired, because it's so easy to access, billions of people find out of them. So I tend to go to those. I also go to LinkUp.com. LinkUp.com is an interesting aggregator. LinkUp trolls all of the individual corporate websites and aggregates them on one website. So you can also get jobs that aren't as easily accessible. Anyway, I thank you for the call. Like I said, all lines are lighted up. Let's go back to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko and Mike Burnick. What's your question or comment for me or him?
Hello?
Hello.
Oh, good. I would appreciate, the guest obviously has a very important perspective because a member of his family suffers from a disability, and that's on a personal level, and yet he has had the, you might call, the big view from his position. And I wonder how the guest feels about programs that government programs that benefit those who are less able, for instance, as his son, in certain areas, and whether he feels that the free market will take care of those things, or whether he feels that and would provide an adequate income for them, or whether he feels that there should be more government programs to help them.
We covered that earlier in the show, but Mike, take another crack at it briefly.
Well, yeah, I think this is one area where the market doesn't work, and that if we want to reduce the unemployment rate at 70 or whatever, 7% or above what it is now, probably higher, we need targeted programs. And there are programs out there. There's East Bay Innovations, there's ARC, and they all do a good job, but they're swimming against the tide. It is so difficult for anyone to get a job. But yes, I do think these groups that I'm aware of, ARC, East Bay Innovations, others are good and worth contacting.
Thank you very much for the call. Let's go back to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko. Mike Burnick, what's your question for him? Hello, it's your turn.
Hello.
Hi.
Okay, they said I was four, but I guess I'm three, so hi.
Hello.
Thank you so much for the service that you bring to all of us.
We try.
I'll try to be brief. I've had a long career, though. I'm midlife, mid-career. I won't tell my age, but...
27, right?
It could potentially be a drawback in this market.
Right.
I don't know. I was a university professor, and I left, mm-hmm. and then I went on to reinvent myself as a nonprofit arts person. I ran my own nonprofit for a number of years.
Mm-hmm.
Then that folded in the last dot-com bubble burst. And then I went on to focus on fund development and got a job as a development director. And I've been in between consulting. So I have now been on the job market for, I would say, almost 10 years. I've become an
Wow.
expert at it, and I'm starting to coach other people like you, like you are doing, based on my own experiences. I've been on unemployment for the last year and a half, and my unemployment has just now run out, and I'm down to zero. I had to leave my own apartment and go to Los Angeles to live more cheaply while subletting my apartment, came back, and down to zero. So there are many shades to this gray that I don't have time to fill in, but my dilemma has been whether to focus on developing my consulting work, which in itself is a full-time engagement with the market, or to focus full-time on getting a job, which I've also been doing. So I've been doing both simultaneously, and yet I'm not able to sustain myself at this low level.
Statistically, of course, it varies with the individual, but statistically, given your track record, I'm not optimistic that being the self-employment route is working well for you. You've got two skills that are invaluable in getting hired. I don't care, and in fact, being older is a plus. I would encourage you to do some combination of being employed as a development person, an assistant director, whatever, and a grant writer. You're very articulate. I loved listening to you. You were crisp. You were smart. You were easygoing. You were focused, but in easygoing, which is exactly what people like. That's what Barack Obama has. He's very focused, but he's easygoing.
Wow, thank you.
Yeah, you have that wonderful attribute. And so I could see you being very successful in fundraising. And as you well know, money is the lifeblood of nonprofits. And so I think that if you focus on, and because you were so articulate, you could probably write good grants. You were a professor. You know, you are bright, clearly bright, and have good credentials. I would target a list of nonprofits, especially in the arts, where they're really, you know, struggling. I would make a list of every nonprofit related to the arts and pitch yourself as a combination, either or both, of a grant writer or a development person. Maybe, and because being older is a real plus in development, because the people who have money to give are not 25. So if you're 50 plus, they will tend to trust you more and be more likely to donate. What's your reaction to that?
Well, partly I appreciate what you're saying about the focus. However, I have been doing that. I'm in the midst of doing that. And I'm just not, for some reason, being able to flip the interviews into a job offer.
Okay, so then that doesn't mean we abandon the goal. I'm wondering whether you have done a good enough job of documenting what you really would bring to the table, both in your resume, in your cover letter, in the interviews, or maybe your references are sabotaging you. If you really took a hard look at all of what you've accomplished, all that you could accomplish, and maybe even that you are forward thinking, that in terms that you have stayed up on, especially as you're older, there's a tendency that you're behind the t- technological curve.
True.
If you understand more about what current development best practices are, maybe taking a brief seminar, a weekend seminar at the Foundation Center or something like that. Right.
Thank you.
So if you've got all of that, then is it possible that the goal is right, but that you haven't optimized your selling, if you will, of what you bring to the table?
I mean, at this point, I'm willing to entertain anything as possible. So I will revisit, as I'm working on a job application today, with your good comments in mind. Again, I have been at this a long time, and I do have a lot of skill sets, including the coaching. So I just don't know. It's very, difficult.
But I notice you said you're answering as, it's a cliche, but more than half of jobs are gotten before they're ever advertised. They're gotten because you have developed a love relationship. This sounds weird. Not a sexual love relationship necessarily, but a kind of a true and intimate bond between somebody with the power to hire you. Have you done enough to strengthen the relationships with people who are in the nonprofit arts community so that when a job comes available and you then go and sell your skills really well, then you become the inside candidate?
I believe so. I really do. My dissertation was on social network research, so
okay.
I'm a pretty good networker.
So what would the goddess say? So here we have a woman who's got a very good skill set, who's very articulate, who has networked well, who uses both the front door that is answering ads as well as the back door, and the goddess who is objective. What would the goddess say is the reason or reasons that you're not getting hired? Because you're sounding like a winner right now to me.
Yeah, this is exactly what I've been trying to put my finger on, really. So if I had the answer to that, maybe I could flip the switch.
Have you gotten enough feedback? Have you begged for honest feedback from people who have interviewed you? Have you had heart-to-hearts with your references? Have you had informational interviews where you're talking and expressing your frustration? Because on paper, the woman who is presenting to me here is a winner. She, even in this tough economy, should be employed. So
thank you. Everyone agrees, including three coaches that I've worked with.
Okay.
Maybe I haven't expressed enough frustration. I tend to hold that very close. This is a very big step for me to call you and express frustration.
You did great, but you're not doing it in a whiny way at all. It's very good. You're perfect. I'm a very straight shooter. If I had concerns about your style, I would tell you. You're doing great. Mike has got a comment. My guest, Mike Burnick, has got a comment for you.
I'd like to ask Mike how I can get my unemployment extended.
Beyond the year and a half.
Yeah, that's not as easy, especially since the federal extensions.
I know.
Because there is. But I agree with everything Marty said.
Thank you.
You're doing all the right things. I would just make 2 points, Marty. One, unfortunately, I can't, this is what I see all the time. It's the new normal. You can do everything right and there's no guarantee of a job at the end. But the one thing I would add is, and I'm sure you're already doing this, is to just get in anyway. Just get in part-time. Get in volunteering. Get in,
good point.
Contingent work. Get in some way.
Yeah, well, I feel like I give away a lot of free consulting with all my networking because people call me for meetings. I give them ideas. They take the ideas and run with them, and then I don't get hired.
Have you volunteered to be on a board? You have enough eminence. You were a professor. You've done all these things.
Yeah.
One of the best. If you're doing these things, I can only tell you that that's best practice. Being on a board is one of the most potent ways to get hired for a good position because people in power get to see how you function in a professional environment all the time, and therefore, they're in a position to say, "This woman is great. I need to hire her." So maybe you need to redouble efforts in that direction. Don't volunteer to give some free consulting advice in your home. That doesn't do good. That
right.
does very little. But if you're on a board, then you really have a chance to develop relationships. Also, should you, because you're so articulate, have you given talks at conferences on some element that is, either on fundraising or on grant writing or whatever? You said coaching, coaching employees in a nonprofit arts environment, whatever it is. Should you be giving talks at conferences attended by people with the power to hire you?
That's a good point. Not in that sector. Not since I left academia, and I've given more than 150 academic talks all over the world.
Yeah, make sure you do. Academic talks are the most boring. They really do not work in the real world.
That's why I left. But that's a question of what is reality is for another spiritual realm.
Right, exactly. But I invite you to think about more like Barack Obama because you reacted well when I said that. Think about how he would make a talk about fundraising or development with a blend of anecdote and statistic, head and heart, passion without being out of control, which is your natural. You already have that gift naturally. And give talks at local chapter meetings, national conferences or whatever on the topics, on something that would be evidence that you are, you know, an expert in something that would make you hireable. So in fundraising, some aspect of fundraising, whether it's database development or individual pitching of people or deferred giving or grant, whatever it is, give a powerful talk. And I think that's going to enhance your chances.
That's a great idea. Okay, well, thank you so much, both of you, for all of that. And I will continue to persevere. It's good to have a little pep talk as I do it.
You deserve one, and I'm really glad you called, and you did not at all come off bad in expressing your vulnerability at all. In fact, you might even express a little more. There's nothing wrong with that. These are tough times. Real winners also suffer, and expressing your feelings will turn off some people, but the right people will be turned on.
Thanks so much. I'll get off the phone and cry. Thanks.
Crying is fun. I like crying, actually.
Okay, wonderful. You guys keep up the good work.
Be well.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye. Let's take one more call. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco, Mike Burnick. What's your question or comment for him or me? Hi. One second. We're just about getting... You're wonderful, Debbie. Thank you very much. Anyway, welcome to the show. What's your quick question or comment for Mike or myself? Hello? Okay. He hung up. Oh, well, such is life. So we've only got a minute or two. What I want to do is... do you have something to say you want me to say? I got some... okay. You like my idea when I told that success story. I always try to balance the negative with the positive. So I told that example of the guy who gets washing machines free from people who are upgrading or whatever and then sells them. Here are some more low-cost businesses that, again, that don't require the job market to change. In fact, they tend to work well in a bad economy. Being an expert at diesel repair, you know, there's a lot of car mechanics out there, but there aren't, you know, there is with ever more delivery from Amazons and the like, being by truck or in UPS or whatever, all these diesel engines need repair. So there's a nice little niche. Helping singles write relationship ads. In good times and in bad, people want relationships. It doesn't cost you anything. It's an easy business to start. More people are having to move into mobile homes. So owning a mobile home park or simply doing something like janitorial, mobile home park cleaning. It's a niche that people wouldn't have thought about. Installing and removing home for sale lawn signs. Every realtor puts signs up. I know there's a company called Smith that dominates it in San Francisco. They simply put in these 4x4 posts and take them out every time a house is for sale. Do it in some other city. It's a no-brainer business. It's something that can be done. Placing and maintaining laundry machines in apartment buildings. And, of course, I've talked about carts, selling flowers, scarves, knockoff designer perch, French soaps. All those kind of things are low-cost businesses that can start. We've got 30 seconds. Any comments about any of that stuff?
As you give the example of these examples and the washing machine guy, it just makes me think that's our real hope, Marty. People out there, it's amazing what people, the initiative people take and frankly, the perseverance. Because the woman was talking about, you know, going through years and years, but... you know, at the Autism Job Club, to come back to that, one of our members recently said, you know, I'm tired. And I think we're all tired. You know, we want people to just give us a job. We're tired of going through all this process of applying jobs. We're tired of being turned down. But amazingly, people continue to persevere. And in the end, that's what we need to do.
Especially with a mentor. And Mike Burnick, thanks very much for being my guest on Work with Marty Nemco. You write a very interesting column that I love to death in Fox and Hounds. How do they get that? Just because I just Google Michael Burnick and get it?
Yeah, just Google me or Fox and Hounds Daily.
Fox and Hounds Daily or Michael Burnick, B-E-R-N-I-C-K.
Right.
That is Work with Marty Nemco for this week. I am not burned out. There is always hope that with intelligence and drive, anything is possible. Next week, my wife, Dr. Barbara Nemco, and I are going to discuss Sheryl Sandberg's best-selling book, Lean In, Women, Work, and the Will to Lead. Plus, you can call in for a 3-minute workover. Until then, I want to just thank my board rapper, Debbie Kennedy, and you, and remind you that we find comfort among those who agree with us, growth among those who don't.
Marty. Marty Nemko's 2,000 articles are free on his website. From there, you also can email him if you'd like coaching on your career or to comment on this program. His site, martynemko.com. That's MartyNemko.com. And join Marty again next Sunday morning at 11 for Work with Marty Nemko here on 91.7 KALW San Francisco.